This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about how watchdog group Common Cause has asked the IRS to review the American Legislative Exchange Council.
These are the bad guys, funded by the major Fortune 500 companies. They drafted the legislation that Governor Scott Walker used in Wisconsin to bust unions. They drafted the legislation called Stand Your Ground, resulting in the murder in Florida. And they're losing some of their legitimacy.
Why did Jose Rodriguez, former head of the CIA's clandestine service, destroy 92 tapes of interrogation sessions with terrorism suspects?
Because they showed how the CIA tortured people. There were evidence of criminality, and there were evidence that could have put him, his superiors, and subordinates behind bars.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, last week on May Day, I ran into you at Union Square in New York City.
What a fabulous demonstration that was. The American people have reclaimed the great workers' holiday, May Day, from the bad guys when they used to call it Law Day. When I was standing there and you came by, I just saw two of my favorite signs. One of them said, "I'm an illegal immigrant. I'm here to take your job, except you don't have one." And another one said, "Capitalism is a sinking ship. May Day."
It was an impressive turnout, Michael. I think there were between 10 and 30,000 people. And I was there from about 11 a.m. till midnight.
I remember when I was growing up, it was called Law Day. I grew up in Wisconsin when Senator Joseph McCarthy was our senator. I couldn't get there at 11 o'clock when you were there because I was out in the Supreme Court in Staten Island on a case. So I walk into the courtroom ready to argue my case, and there's no judge there. The courtroom is filled with about 150 10-year-olds and a bunch of cops with these ceremonial rifles. So I asked the clerk, "What's going on?" He said, "Well, all court appearances have been canceled for Law Day." I had two reactions. One was, this is a discourtesy to me because I had to schlep over there on the ferry. But the other one was, Law Day? These people should be celebrating May Day. If they told the kids about the tradition of May Day, which started off in Chicago, it's an American holiday for the eight-hour day. If they told the kids about May Day, they'd learn something. But tell them about Law Day? Then my second thought was, well, I wish Heidi and Michael were here with me because we could talk about Law and Disorder Day.
And all those police with guns in the courtroom.
Yes.
Kind of irregular.
They're not in the courtroom. They're out in Occupy Wall Street. I mean, that demonstration on May Day was so over-policed, it was unbelievable.
It was over-policed. Now, I understand that you have a few words from a dear friend of ours.
Lynn Stewart wrote in some thoughts on May Day, and I wanted to share a couple of them with you in the audience. Lynn writes, "The only progress to be sought on May Day 2012 by all of us is a unity of purpose. By truly believing that an injury to one is an injury to all, and acting in self-defense against the powerful, unscrupulous forces who seek to destroy our movement. May Day is the beginning of new offensives, and we certainly have a lot of choices. There's so much wrong, so much that needs fixing. We must band together until they are more afraid of our power than their greedy fear of losing their vast fortunes. This we must do. Our children and grandchildren assure us that there's no choice if there's to be a world for them to live and work in and raise the next generations in."
Well, beautifully said by Lynn Stewart. Michael, our next update is a local story, but one that has, I think, national and constitutional repercussions.
I think so. This retired 80-year-old chemistry professor, Julian P. Heiklin, was tried for jury tampering, and he was acquitted yesterday. The prosecution said what he did was a significant, important threat to our judicial system. Well, what did he do? He used to stand outside of the federal courthouse at 500 Pearl Street, where Lynn Stewart was convicted, incidentally. And he would hand out leaflets telling passersby some of them who may have been jurors on a case inside the building, but he didn't know who they were. But he was just passing out leaflets, and the leaflets informed citizens of their right of jury nullification, which is that if you're sitting on a jury, you don't like the law, you don't have to find the guy guilty. Well, the prosecutors went crazy, and they indicted this 80-year-old retired chemistry professor for jury tampering. He went to trial.
And he represented himself, didn't he?
Yeah, he represented himself. Judge Kimblewood threw out the case, and she said, you don't even have the law right here, prosecutors. Jury tampering is defined as if you write a letter and give it to a juror who's sitting on a particular case in an attempt to influence them. That's jury tampering. But standing out in the corner and passing out a leaflet telling people who are American citizens that they got a right to make up their own mind if they sit on a jury, you know, that's free speech.
That's First Amendment, and I'm glad the prosecutors got a lesson on that one.
Yeah, really.
Michael, last week in New York, two lawsuits were filed on the same day, actually, involving protesters, free speech. One of them is a federal lawsuit alleging that the New York City Police Department improperly uses barricades to trap and contain protesters. This case asked the judge to issue an order forbidding certain use of barricades, and it stemmed from a visit that Obama had last November. He was at a fundraiser at the Sheraton Hotel when approximately 100 protesters from Occupy Wall Street demonstrated outside of the hotel. Police directed them to stand between barricades that they had arranged in a U-shape about 100 feet away. 10 minutes after they entered the pendant area, the officers put a final group of barricades into place, which in effect trapped them for 2 hours. The complaint in the lawsuit says, and I'm quoting, "Demonstrators were treated differently than others at the same intersection at the same time. NYPD officials told plaintiffs and others in the pen they were being held because they were protesters. Tourists who were trapped in the pen, as well as journalists, were released while the demonstrators were held." Essentially, this kind of barricading violates a provision of the police patrol guide in addition to the First, Fourth, and 14th Amendments. And the patrol guide says people should be allowed to leave barricaded areas at any time. We had a case in 2004 in which plaintiffs complained about being penned in during the big anti-war demonstration, you may remember. And Judge Robert Sweet of Federal District Court said, "The NYPD is enjoined from unreasonably restricting access to and from demonstrations through the use of pens." And Michael, at May Day last week, we saw blocks and blocks of pens, and you couldn't get out. They were all interlocked, which is a safety hazard.
You know, I noticed that, too, when I was walking over to the demonstration. They must have spent millions of dollars on it. They're like steel fences, and they interlock so they can rearrange them. And I thought, well, it's two purposes. One is to keep the demonstrators where they are, but the other purpose is to keep people who want to be demonstrators from joining the demonstration.
Exactly.
The corollary to that is that if you want to demonstrate, they say, okay, we'll give you a free speech zone about 2 miles from where you want to demonstrate.
Right. And what was interesting last week at the latter part of the May Day march, which went from Union Square all the way down to Wall Street, is that if you wanted to get out of these penned areas, you had to walk literally 15 city blocks. They weren't letting you out.
Yeah.
It's clearly an effort to control the flow, as you say, not to let people in. And it really can be frightening if there's large numbers of people, which there were last week. If someone panics or wants to get out, if you're an elderly person or you have a medical condition, it's dangerous.
They were first used in New York at the time of that massive demonstration when the Bush war against Iraq was about to be launched.
Right.
You remember, hundreds of thousands of people came out. And a friend of mine who was in a wheelchair, who was 80 years old and frail, came out to demonstrate. He had to talk his way through that barricade by telling a cop that he was a World War II veteran, and finally got in. It's really creepy the way they're using the police in these barricades to really stifle free speech in a very effective way.
That's right. And I think one of the points that really will help the plaintiffs in this current case is that the police said they were there because they were protesters.
I know.
And they let others leave.
I know. The other lawsuit that you mentioned that was filed by four city council persons.
That's right.
For police abuse.
Right.
Now, we're not talking
during Occupy Wall Street.
You know, your very frequent lawsuit for police abuse, which happens a lot around the country and a lot with this New York City vicious police department. These aren't just citizens. These are citizens who are on a city council,
right,
who themselves were abused by the cops. So much for when you have a city run by a mayor who's worth $13.4 billion and a really rogue police chief.
Possibly to become our next mayor, by the way.
In a recent interview on CBS's famed news program, 60 Minutes, Leslie Stahl interviewed the former head of the CIA's clandestine service, Jose Rodriguez Jr., and he discussed his destruction of 92 videotapes in which terrorism suspects were waterboarded and otherwise subject to other forms of torture. Rodriguez told Stahl that he destroyed the tapes to protect the people who worked for him at various black sites. But critics say Rodriguez is afraid of criminal prosecution, either here or abroad, because those 92 tapes contained evidence of criminality and are a threat to Rodriguez and those who approved the use of torture, starting with President Bush. Rodriguez, a 30-year veteran of the CIA, had spent most of his career overseeing similar operations in Latin and Central America, including Argentina, El Salvador, and Nicaragua. Rodriguez supports the idea that torture works, and he claims that because of the torture, Osama bin Laden was located. We talk more about this unfolding story with New York attorney Scott Horton. Scott is known for his work in human rights law and the law of armed conflict. He's a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine.
Scott, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Great to be with you.
I wanted to ask first, what's wrong essentially with Rodriguez's claims that destroying the tapes was done to protect the people who worked for him?
Well, I'd say that's almost certainly false. It's clear enough. I mean, he says that their identities would have gotten out and they would have become targets of Al-Qaeda. That was his response to Leslie Stahl in the CBS 60 Minutes interview on Sunday evening. But, you know, in fact, we know that the government, in response to FOIA requests and litigation requests, has released photographs and tapes repeatedly in the past, and when it does so, it always obliterates the faces of the American personnel involved. So, of course, their identities are not released. And then second, this idea that they're going to be the subjects of, you know, some sort of Al-Qaeda hit runs into some pretty serious problems. I mean, starting with the fact that as Barack Obama announced in his speech from Kabul, Al-Qaeda has been defeated. It's a fringe group right now, a faint shadow of what it was before. It doesn't really present the same sort of threat to the United States. And even if Al-Qaeda was going to strike somebody in the U.S., it's hardly like second and third tier CIA officers that they're going after. That doesn't make any sense. So what's the real reason for the destruction of the tapes? And I think that's pretty clear. The tapes contained evidence of crimes. They showed the use of waterboarding and other techniques, or torture techniques. It documented those techniques, and that really presented a risk to Jose Rodriguez and to the people up above Rodriguez who were responsible for putting through torture policy. And I think Rodriguez had to be concerned that people who saw those tapes would be horrified by them, and that these things will be a powerful tool for transforming public opinion, which right now is highly tolerant of torture. And I note that Jose Rodriguez, of course, spent almost his entire career down in Latin America. He was one of the key leaders of the CIA's clandestine service down there. He worked in Argentina for many, many years, stationed in Buenos Aires. And he would have known what was going on there, because after the dirty war in Argentina, the generals who used torture and torture techniques, as did the generals across the water in Uruguay and in Chile, they all began running into problems 10, 20, and 30 years out. And that was largely driven by disclosures about the details of what they did, including release of photographs, tapes, and forensic evidence. Popular opinion in those countries turned against torture. The people began to demand prosecutions. And in fact, just in the last 5 years, we've seen prosecutions and convictions of the former heads of state and heads of the intelligence services in both Argentina and Uruguay. And Rodriguez saw that. He knew what was going on. And I think that's what drove his decision.
Who are we talking about in terms of his superiors that were protected by the destruction of those 92 videotapes?
We have pretty good information about the decision process, and we know it went through the CIA to the top. Certainly George Tenet was involved.
At the CIA,
that's right. Stephen Kappes at the CIA clearly was involved in this. It moved over to the Department of Justice, where we know the lawyers at the Office of Legal Counsel were involved.
And who are those lawyers, and where are they now?
Bybee.
He's a judge, right?
He's a federal judge out in the Ninth Circuit, based in Las Vegas, in fact. And John Yu, who's a professor at the University of California. Stephen Bradbury, who's now a partner in a law firm in Washington, D.C. And then it went into the White House, where it went into the National Security Council. And we know that there were principals meetings there. We know that Condoleezza Rice and their successor, Stephen Hadley, were both involved in these decisions. But I'd say the trail consistently leads straight into the office of Vice President Dick Cheney. I'm very, very clear that he was the key mover for the introduction of torture policy and the person who pressed to the head very aggressively when it ran into opposition. He was the decider, so to speak.
Scott Horton, what laws did the use of torture violate?
Well, domestically in the United States, we have an anti-torture statute that includes for conspiracy to torture. Both of those things were violated. They apply outside of the United States, so they would have applied to the conduct of a CIA agent operating in Poland or Thailand, for instance. But then we also have state statutes that also provide the same prohibition. We have a War Crimes Act. So that's American law, but we have to understand the CIA was doing this mostly outside of the United States, and we know it was running these facilities in Poland, Lithuania, areas in North Africa, and in Thailand. The best documentation we have right now tells us that Abu Zubaydah was, in fact, waterboarded in Poland, and there's an open criminal investigation that's already produced indictments in Poland because Poland has an anti-torture statute. There's no question but that what was done was a serious crime under Polish law that could result in sending people to prison for long periods of time. And the criminal investigation in Poland right now aims, in fact, to do that. And Jose Rodriguez, I think, one of the interesting things is the statements to Leslie Stahl probably subject him to being prosecuted in Poland or in other jurisdictions where these things happen. And I wouldn't rule out that possibility either.
And Scott, that makes me ask, why did he go on national TV with this and why now?
His motives, I think, are they're nuanced. But I'd say, first of all, he's trying to make money. He's selling a book. And what you saw was a 36-minute advertisement for his book published by an affiliate of CBS on CBS broadcast. I'd say beyond that, he's also trying to build sympathy and beat back calls for his own prosecution. But it's a very interesting strategy he's pursuing, and I think this was an ill-advised strategy, and I think he confessed to criminal conduct in the course of this interview, and that could very well come back to haunt him in the future.
What do you make of the claim that waterboarding KSM, waterboarding him, torturing others, what do you make of the claim that that led to the identifying of the courier, which led to the location of Osama bin Laden, which led to his assassination?
It's definitely not true. You know, we have fairly detailed information on the timeline, and we know that the information that led to this individual being identified and later tracked was information that had been secured before waterboarding was applied. So it's clear that there's no connection between waterboarding and the receipt of this information. In fact, you know, so far, neither Rodriguez nor others who are trying to justify the use of these tactics have yet been able to come up with anything, that any really positive breakthrough that came from the use of these techniques. At one point, they claimed that we were able to track down and pick up Jose Padilla through the use of waterboarding, which is very, very interesting because Padilla had been arrested and was in U.S. custody before the first case of waterboarding was applied. So I guess they had to make use of a time machine for that.
Scott, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence is finishing up a 3-year study on the efficacy of the CIA techniques. What do you think that study is going to yield?
Well, I've spoken to some people who've read it. I know that there's quite a controversy about its release, that there are people in the agency who really don't want it out, or they want it released only with heavy redactions. But I'm told that it says, basically, it goes over very carefully all these claims that have been trotted out by Rodriguez and others about breakthroughs or accomplishments that are tied to the use of enhanced interrogation techniques. And it says basically, no, wrong. I mean, in every one of these claims, we can actually go back and look at the facts and say, no, there really was no breakthrough that was achieved by this. In most cases, it wasn't even corroborative of things that had already come through. One thing that comes through very clearly is that the FBI interrogators, and that's particularly a guy named Ali Soufan, who really comes out of this as an incredible hero, had a far better track record at getting breakthroughs and getting them on a timely basis and developing them than the CIA. I mean, the CIA was just coming up snake eyes over and over and over again, and the more they used these harsh techniques, the less information they in fact got. They usually got people to shut up over time and stop cooperating. So from what I understand, the Senate Select Committee report basically says there was little or no advantage gained from the use of these techniques, and it appears pretty clear that the standard techniques that are used by the FBI, which are based on rapport building, were in fact far more effective in getting timely information than were these enhanced interrogation techniques.
So, Scott Horton, we've clearly established that torturing people is not just illegal and immoral, but unproductive. So how do you explain the popularity of enhanced techniques in the American population, which I think explains why nobody's been prosecuted? How do you explain that?
Well, I think it's a combination of two things. I mean, one is television programs like 24, which have lionized torturers and the use of torture. And in fact, when we look at American popular culture, there has been this really dramatic and shocking turnaround where you look at American movies during the era of World War II and the Korean War and the Vietnam War, and torture is something that's done by the enemy. It's a tool of the enemy. It's the evil guys who do it. And then we jump forward to the era of George W. Bush, and suddenly Hollywood does a complete 180-degree turn, and suddenly torture is what the heroes do, and people who resist torture are these fools who don't really care about the safety of American citizens. So I think this popular culture is a big part of it. But I think it's also the political dialogue where Republican torture advocates like Willard Mitford Romney and people close to him have been out there punching away constantly advocating torture. And the response from Barack Obama has been silence. Silence. I mean, he and his advisors seem to have concluded that this isn't a useful issue for them, so they backed away from it.
Christopher Exley, who was a Harvard law professor, who's now the dean at Bolt Hall at the University of California Law School out in California, was on the transition team.
Yes.
And they had a panel discussion about 5 months ago out at Bolt Hall about the transition team. And somebody asked him if they discussed whether they were going to recommend to the Obama people prosecuting these torturers. And Exley said no. They discussed it, and then they decided not to raise that with the Obama people at all. And he said he was afraid of extreme CIA retribution if they did.
I've heard actually from several different people that account, and I have to say I find it to be really shocking. I mean, it's suggesting that they believe the CIA would engage in sabotage. Basically, it's suggesting disloyalty on the part of CIA agents. And, when I watched on 60 Minutes, when I watched Jose Rodriguez speak, I thought the disloyalty in his comments was also astonishing. His view was that, he was bound by what George Bush and Dick Cheney thought. But with respect to Barack Obama, well, he's just entitled to his opinions, as if he's not the commander-in-chief somehow. And I also got to say, the guy came across to me as something of a psychopath, as a head case. And it's amazing to me that somebody like that would occupy a position as sensitive and as important as head of the clandestine service.
he violated a court order in destroying evidence. He should have been indicted a lot quicker than Lynn Stewart was indicted. It really is shocking that a gentleman like Jose A. Rodriguez Jr. walks the streets probably living on a good pension from our taxpayer dollars.
And is making money now off of, you know, his bragging about the fact about how he broke the law and got away with it. That's also amazing. And also amazing that CBS gives him 36 minutes to do this in, prime airtime.
You know, Leslie Stahl is, I think one could describe her interview technique sometimes as fawning. And I remember when she interviewed Madeleine Albright, who was Secretary of State, and she asked Madam Secretary about the reports that had been documented in England that 600,000 Iraqi children had died as a consequence of American sanctions. And she said to Albright, do you think it was worth it? And Albright said, yes. And this is now a woman who's been awarded the Congressional Medal of Freedom, or the Presidential Medal of Freedom. It's really distressing to see that big media and the top politicians and governmental people and the CIA, they all seem to be able to get away with literally atrocities.
I just say Leslie Stahl, I thought she was amazingly ineffective in presenting questions, and she allowed Jose Rodriguez to get out a whole series of whoppers without challenging him on things. I mean, for instance, she said that Rodriguez claims that waterboarding works and that good information was gotten from it. The FBI say that that the claims about Abu Zubaydah are false because, in fact, they got the information from Abu Zubaydah. The real information is all classified. We don't know who's telling the truth. I mean, that's just utter nonsense. I mean, the FBI's information is out and is public, and it fully substantiates the FBI's claims. The CIA's information has been reviewed by Senate committees, both the Committee on Armed Services and the Select Committee on Intelligence, and they both of those committees say that the CIA evidence does not support the conclusions that Rodriguez offered. So, you know, the characterization that CBS put on this was just wrong.
And Scott, I think the danger of that interview, as mainstream as that program is that it contributes to the effect you mentioned earlier about popular culture and TV programs lionizing torture. This does nothing to challenge or criticize that practice.
That's right. In fact, we saw Leslie Stahl, you know, talking about some of these enhanced techniques, putting a prisoner in a box with rodents, waterboarding, a running drill to someone's head. And she did this with a smile and smirk on her face, just totally inappropriate. I was really appalled by that.
Scott, once again, it's been an honor to have you on Law and Disorder, and we loved your article, and we'll post a link to it on our website.
Well, it's great to be with you. I listen to your program whenever I can.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you. Horton. Have a great day.
Take care.
Bye. Bye-bye. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. The American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, is a tax-exempt charity that spends millions of dollars annually to lobby for hundreds of bills in state legislatures around the United States. It recently came to the attention of the public for having drafted and pressured passage of the so-called Stand Your Ground legislation after the shooting death of Trayvon Martin in February. The watchdog group Common Cause has asked the IRS to review Alec's status, claiming that Alec is, quote, a corporate lobby masquerading as a charity, and that contributors should not be allowed to claim the gifts as charitable contributions. We're joined today by Common Cause attorney Nick Sergey, who conducted the research helping to expose the American Legislative Exchange Council. Nick, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Alec's website describes the association as nonpartisan, but in fact, your research reveals that they are a group of very conservative state legislators. Why should this be an issue of concern?
Well, I think it's concerning for a number of reasons. Alec describes itself as nonpartisan, although the majority of its members are certainly in the Republican Party. There are Democrats who are members. It's concerning from a tax perspective because Alec is operating as a 501c nonprofit, which means it's a charity, and therefore corporations who are members of Alec are able to take a tax deduction when they contribute up to hundreds of thousands of dollars, some of them, to be members of Alec, which means lobbying, which is done on behalf of these corporations, if it's Visa or Verizon or Amazon, if they were to lobby their state house, then those lobbying activities would not be tax deductible. They would be subject to tax, but they do the same lobbying through Alec, and all of those contributions are essentially subsidized by us, the taxpayer. And that's wrong. We shouldn't be subsidizing the lobbying activities of any corporations.
Nick, give us a flavor of what kind of bills Alec draws up to be guided through the various state legislatures. What kind of harm do these people do?
Until recently, Alec operated 9 task forces. They were forced to close one of them 2 weeks ago, which was their Public Safety and Elections Task Force. There was a lot of criticism, mainly because of one particular bill that came out of that task force. That was the Stand Your Ground bill. Alec actually called it the Castle Doctrine, which was hid really what that bill did.
Your home is your castle.
But that's always been the law.
Yes, right.
This one said something different.
This model bill, which actually ended up in 24 states, but this bill enabled you to do much more than just protect your castle, protect your home. It enabled you to potentially do what we saw happening in Florida, which is that you can extend beyond your castle. You can go out into the streets. You can be in your workplace, and you can use deadly force in situations that you otherwise wouldn't be able to do simply by invoking.
Stand your ground.
Right. But this bill is very interesting. This was a bill that was drafted by the NRA and was lobbied by them and presented to legislators in Florida in April 2005. And the NRA were very closely involved in that passing in April 2005. And then a couple of months later, they took it to the Alec Task Force, which they paid to be a member of, the Public Safety and Elections Task Force. They sponsored it. The task force was chaired by Walmart. Walmart have their own interest in working with the gun lobby in that they're the largest retailer of weapons in the United States. There was a vote of 2 votes within that task force. One, the legislators who are members of that task force, they voted for it. They unanimously passed it. And then there was a vote of the private sector members, so the NRA, Walmart, and the other members of that task force. They unanimously passed it, so they all voted for it. Alec then took that model bill and lobbied for it in numerous states, and that bill has now become law in 24 states. And that's just one example. Alec has over 800 model bills that they have in their library.
One of the other bills that we've discussed on Law and Disorder is the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. This was introduced years ago and then on a federal level then went on to be adopted in many states around the country.
Yes, so these are the ag-gag bills. Alec organizes around these 9 task forces. They have bills that really cover almost every policy area. Their Public Safety and Elections Task Force that had the Stand Your Ground bill was concerned with a lot of social issues, not universally, but the other task forces, the other 8 task forces, cover areas such as rolling back environmental protections. That comes out of their Environment Task Force, or they have a Commerce Task Force where a lot of the anti-union bills, the right to work legislation, that comes from that task force. They have a tax task force that deals with reducing corporate tax burdens. And we saw an example of one of the bills that came out of that task force, which was actually a resolution calling on the federal government, which is something that is often done through ALEC. Corporations will use the states essentially to lobby the federal government on their behalf. And this was a resolution that was calling on the federal government to reduce corporate taxes. And it was passed at last summer's ALEC conference down in New Orleans. And then it was immediately taken by a Florida legislator called Rachel Bergen, who introduced it but paid such little attention to what she was introducing that she forgot to remove the first paragraph of the model, which on all ALEC bills is a paragraph that explains what ALEC is, not what the bill is. And she realized her mistake quickly after 24 hours, withdrew the bill. She didn't amend it. She withdrew it and then introduced a new model bill, which was exactly the same, except without that telltale paragraph that described ALEC.
Well, in fact, that points out how ALEC's model really differs from traditional forms of lobbying and advocacy, because the corporations are given extraordinary power to shape the bill under ALEC's system, but there is often no clear evidence of this corporate influence when the bills are introduced, except, as you pointed out, in accidental occasions.
That's absolutely right, and ALEC does their best in order to play down the role that corporations have. One of the documents that we submitted to the IRS last week, when we submitted about 4,000 pages of evidence accompanying IRS whistleblower submission, one of these documents was a set of talking points that ALEC sent out at the beginning of 2011 to legislators. They were starting to get increased criticism in the press at that time about how ALEC was operating and the role of the corporations. These talking points were designed, in fact, they made very clear that they were to be used by legislators when they are getting difficult questions from the press or in committees about their involvement with ALEC. One of those questions was talking about the role that the corporations play, and they were told that a suitable answer was to say that the corporations don't vote on legislation. The documents that we submitted to the IRS shows that that is completely false. In fact, the corporations vote separately from the legislators. We've seen examples of where the corporations voting together have blocked the will of the legislators. So legislators have wanted ALEC to take up particular issues. They've wanted them to promote particular bills. And the corporations have said, no, this is not in the interest of, it's not in our interests. And so they've blocked it. And in fact, we've even seen an example where a simple tie of the corporations, 8-8, they couldn't get a majority, and it was killed, and ALEC didn't take it any further.
Talk a bit about ALEC's track record of success. I know that a few years ago, I think for the legislative session in 2007-8, 751 bills based on ALEC model legislation were introduced. 118 of these were enacted, and that is actually a very high success rate of nearly 16%.
That's right, but we believe that rate has actually improved, from ALEC's perspective, improved since then. ALEC put out a corporate recruitment brochure last year, and in that they boasted that there are around 1,000 model bills that were introduced with a success rate of 17%, so that would be 170. And there have been years in the past where ALEC has had even more model bills introduced than that. There was a document that we found in the tobacco archives based at UC Berkeley. This was a document that had been sent to Reynolds Tobacco by ALEC in 1995. And it was talking about what a great year that had been for ALEC. So many bills had passed. And they said, ALEC is a great return on investment. This is what they're telling the corporations. Nowhere else can you get a return that high. We don't have a complete picture of everything that ALEC has been doing over the last 40 years. Common Cause has a very good picture over the last 2 years, and this formed the basis of this massive IRS submission that we filed last week, 4,000 pages, and I can come on talk more about that if you like. But we do have certain documents that have come up through the years that have been found in certain archives or that have been leaked over the years. One of the documents that we've seen popping up time and again are these scorecards, which they send to the corporate members, where they really celebrate the success that they have. And in some of these older scorecards, I think before the age of the internet and people were afraid of these documents really being everywhere instantly, they mapped out the complete picture of the United States and where all of their model bills had been introduced and passed. And they were really celebrating this to the corporations. I mean, Alec pretends that the corporations are involved, you know, out of the goodness of their heart. They're there to merely advise. But obviously that's not true. The corporations are there because they're looking for some kind of return on their investment. And they have a legislative agenda and they want to meet with these legislators and promote that, and that's why they're involved in ALEC, and ALEC plays that up in their communications to these corporate members.
Nick, we do want to talk about the complaint that Common Cause filed with the IRS. Can you tell us a bit about what it means to file a complaint? Does that automatically result in an audit of ALEC's work?
Well, this is the second time in the last year that we filed with the IRS. Last July, we filed a fairly modest request with the IRS. It was about 60 pages, and we thought at that time that we saw smoke in terms of ALEC lobbying and acting in for private interest. We thought we had a very strong case, but we were asking the IRS to investigate. And then over the course of the last year, we, from various different sources, including a source that's provided us with emails going between ALEC and state legislators, we have all of these thousands of pages of documents. We've used a different mechanism with this filing, which is a whistleblower complaint. And we were very grateful to be represented pro bono by one of the country's leading whistleblower firms, Phillips & Cohen. And Eric Havian actually wrote the complaint from Phillips & Cohen. This does trigger a response. We don't know how long it's going to take. It could be that it's a fairly lengthy period of time. But it does require the IRS to look at it, and it does require them to inform us some point where the process has got to.
There's been a massive corporate exodus prompted in part by the growing scrutiny of ALEC's activities. What happened with the Stand Your Ground and voter ID laws?
Voter ID over the last year has been very increasingly connected to ALEC. Voter ID is actually a very interesting issue to campaign on in relation to ALEC. There's a lot of misunderstanding about the level of fraud that exists. Actually, levels of fraud in relation to ID at polls is minuscule or almost unrecordable in most states, and yet people are concerned, which is understandable, about fraud occurring in elections. We believe that the biggest fraud is disenfranchising millions of predominantly African-American elderly or, you know, young student voters. Voter ID is an idea. These laws have been around for many, many years, but it wasn't until 2009 when ALEC took it up that they really injected energy in this at the state level, and it's now been introduced in 34 states. ALEC has an ability to take a law, not necessarily a new law, but to take a law and really sell it to their almost 2,000 state legislator members. ALEC has about a third of all state legislators in the entire country as members.
A third?
A third, that's what they claim. They say they have about 2,000. Actually, there's 7,500 or thereabouts state legislators in the country, so it's a little under a third, but it's a huge number. And actually, when you consider that most of ALEC's members are Republican, you know, they have a very significant proportion of Republican state legislators. We did a report that came out last year. It was a joint report with some other organizations, People for the American Way and some other organizations. And we looked at the number of legislators in Arizona who are members of ALEC. We were able to identify 60, and that's 60 out of 90 state legislators in Arizona, so two-thirds. Then when we looked at the number that were Republican, there was a very small handful of Republican legislators in Arizona who are not ALEC members.
From the perspective of the 1% and the 99%, it seems to me that the 1% is extremely conscious of what their interests are and extremely well organized. And they've got this beautifully oiled machine. But the 99%, what do we have? Do we have an ALEC?
Well, there have been other organizations that have tried to create a progressive rival to ALEC. There is the Progressive States Network. They share some similarities in the sense that they are trying to promote a legislative agenda. However, they thankfully don't have some of the really big problems that ALEC have, mainly two that I would highlight. One is the fact that ALEC is receiving a public subsidy in order to do what it's doing. But secondly, that really the power within ALEC lies with the corporations. It doesn't lie with the legislators. ALEC claims that it's educating. It claims that it's doing research, analysis, and education, and that's why it should get a public subsidy. But really, we know from the documents that we submitted with the IRS that literally have the name of the corporation stamped next to the bill. So there's a fracking bill, and it was sponsored by ExxonMobil. There are bills to privatize education or to try and move towards online charter schools so there's no bricks and mortar schools. And those are sponsored by private education organizations. It's clear when you actually see the materials who's driving this agenda, and then you find out that all of the funding is coming from the corporations as well, you know, and it's clear where the power lies within that organization. As far as we know, is not the case with the Progressive States Network. So I think there are moves afoot to try and create other progressive alternatives to ALEC, but those organizations must be careful that they don't recreate the problems that ALEC has at the same time.
We're speaking with Nick Sergey from Common Cause, who just launched a whistleblower complaint against ALEC, the conservative nationwide coordinated lobbying organization. Where can our listeners continue to follow the story, Nick?
Well, they can look on our website, which is commoncause.org. There's another great website, which is run by the Center for Media and Democracy, and that's called ALEC Exposed. It's at alecexposed.org, and that really, the Center for Media and Democracy do some great research on ALEC, but it also acts as a hub for all things ALEC, and so reports that we put out, stories that we put out also end up there. But we do put additional things on our own website and on our blog, which is commonblog.org.
Nick, is the actual complaint that you filed with the IRS on your website?
Yes. So we have uploaded a copy onto our website, and we've actually included all of the links to all of the documents so people can go on there and have a look. And we're hoping that people are going to crowdsource work through all of these documents. There's so many thousands of pages, and there's so many interesting stories to be told that people are already digging through, and we're seeing stories pop up all over the country referencing these documents. There was a story that was posted on Media Matters just today that was looking at an NRA bill that was passed through ALEC's conference last year, and that wasn't something that we'd noticed, but they looked through these materials and they took that, and now more and more people are finding out about ALEC. So we do encourage people to look on the website and look at the materials.
Since you've been poring through all these documents for a while, I note that AT&T is a member of the Telecommunications and Information Technology Task Force. Was there anything that you can recall related to, like, spying on individuals or that kind of thing?
I haven't seen any bills on that. And actually, the telecommunications industry is pretty much universally represented on them.
Oh, right.
On that particular
not just
force.
AT&T.
So, the telecommunications industry, pretty much all represented on that particular task force. So AT&T are there, as are Sprint, Verizon, Comcast. Credo are not there, the Progressive Telephone Network, but Sprint are, and pretty much every other carrier.
Do you have any favorite stories that came out of your research into this that you want to share with our listeners?
There are a couple of things that we found in the documents, and we shared all of these materials with the New York Times. There was a major front page story on ALEC 2 weeks ago on the Sunday. We shared all of these materials before we went live with the whistleblower submission the following day. There were two things that I would highlight. One is that there was a bill that was sponsored by ExxonMobil. This happened at ALEC's conference in Arizona in December last year. And this bill, on the face of it, appeared to be a disclosure bill for the fracking industry, for them to disclose the makeup of the fluid that they inject into the shale rock at very high pressure. There have been increasing concerns that some of these materials have been ended up in drinking water. And so it's a hot button issue, and many people are concerned about finding out exactly what is in those that liquid that they're injecting in. Anyway, this is apparently, on the face of it, a disclosure bill. However, buried within one of the clauses is a get out of jail free card for these corporations, because it's a clause that says that where a corporation feels that it has trade secrets to protect, they don't have to disclose. That trade secrets provision can be challenged, but there are very few people that can actually challenge it in the state. And so essentially it protects the corporations. it's a very disingenuous bill. I think it's not impossible to find that if you have a close reading of the bill, but this is really one of the big problems with ALEC. When this model bill comes out of the other side, it's gone through ALEC's processes, it's been voted on at the task forces, the corporations have got their way, and this bill has become an ALEC model. Nobody knows that that bill was written by ExxonMobil, one of the largest corporations that are involved with fracking in the United States. And so when state legislators are looking at this bill and they think it's a fracking bill, they may not agree that corporations should be able to essentially do the opposite of what this bill says. Many of these state legislators have very few, if any, staff. Many of these legislators are true citizen legislators. You know, they're paid very little, if anything at all. They have few staff. The session might only be a few weeks, which is the case in many states. And they're there and they're trying to debate and pass many, many, many bills. And this is how a lot of this legislation squeaks through and becomes law, because there is a huge imbalance in the power. The corporations have a whole team of corporate lawyers writing this clever bill. The legislators often have nobody to review this. So it could be that many of these legislators are in favor of that provision, but others will have been completely unaware that this bill did the opposite of what it claimed to do. So that's one example. There's another example which I think is very interesting, which was an email exchange that we found through a public records request in Ohio. It was a state senator there called Bill Seitz, who is on the ALEC board, and he also chairs one of ALEC's task forces that's concerned with tort reform. And there have been moves in many states in order to pass state false claims laws that would enable the states to recoup money from state contractors, corporations, typically pharmaceutical corporations, but not exclusively, who have overcharged the state. And there's a federal law that does this, but there are state laws that enable the states to recoup even more. Usually there's a multiplier effect. So if the corporation has overcharged by X, then the state can recoup maybe three times that amount. This is typically a law that Republicans are very in favor of. Actually, usually this law comes from Republicans. And in Ohio, that is what was happening last year. There was a House bill that was sponsored by Republicans. There was a Democrat who was a co-sponsor. But it was predominantly a Republican bill. And then there were two Republicans in the Senate who were pushing for this. Seitz, the ALEC board member, sent a memo to John Adams, who's the ALEC state chair. He runs the operations of ALEC in the state of Ohio, along with Time Warner, who's his co-chair in Ohio. They really run the operation. This memo said essentially that he'd had conversations with people at an ALEC conference, and they had told him that this bill would not be well received. And he acknowledged the fact that it was difficult to continue to advocate against this legislation because the state is broke, but that ALEC were not in favor of it and that they should do their best to stop it for the good of the order.
I wish we had more time to talk to you, because this is a great and a very important thing that you've done. We've been speaking with Nick Sergey from Common Cause, who's done a whistleblower action against ALEC, the conservative, they would call themselves, I would say, reactionary legislative coordinating lobbying group. Nick, thank you very much. We look forward to having you back on Law and Disorder to get an update on the progress of your whistleblower complaint.
Nick, fascinating. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys. Okay.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Thank you.